Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Judge Smith, Judge Frisch, the Honorable John Schmidt presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 11th, and we have three cases on for argument today. And I'll ask the marshal to go ahead and call the first case.
Calling A240271, State of Minnesota versus Engel.
All right, and counsel, for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes. The podium adjusts, so feel free to raise or lower it as you want. Counsel for respondent, you'll also have 15 minutes, and then you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is being recorded and live streamed. The audio will be available later, so please make sure you say your name, who you are, and who you represent. And counsel, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Claire Glenn, and I represent the appellant, Nicholas Norton Engel. This case is one that involves numerous violations of Mr. Engel's rights before trial, during trial, and even after trial. And we've laid out in our brief the multiple reasons why Mr. Engel's conviction cannot fairly stand. Any one of them is sufficient basis for a reversal. However, I want to start today by addressing the insufficiency of the evidence, because if the court reverses the conviction on that ground, it need not reach the others. Mr. Engel was charged with felony fleeing, and that is a specific intent offense, meaning that Mr. Engel could only be convicted upon proof of specific intent to flee and elude the officer. The state's case relied on circumstantial evidence. Mr. Engel at all times has maintained his innocence, that rather than a specific intent to flee and elude, Mr. Engel intended only to delay pulling over. Now, the state's brief fails to mention some critical circumstances which were proved. This is applying the circumstantial review test, which is a two-step test. And at the first step, this court does defer to the jury's findings of the circumstances proved that are not inconsistent with the verdict. But those circumstances include the fact that Mr. Engel was not seized until after the officer had been following him for 3 miles. 3 miles during which time he had done nothing wrong.
Counsel, one of the circumstances proved, I think, is also that there was a point in time when the officer circled around your client, stopped his squad car, got out of the squad car, told your client to stop, and then your client sped away and accelerated. I mean, I watched the video. That's what it depicts. Do you agree with that characterization of the facts?
I don't know that I would agree with the word sped, but I...
He accelerated.
Right. Accelerated to a speed well below the speed limit on the highway.
So why is it unreasonable for the jury to conclude, just based on that circumstance proved, that there was an illusion that would satisfy the elements of the fleeing statute?
We're not arguing that guilt is an unreasonable inference, but that's not the standard here.
But we do take the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict.
True, in determining what the circumstances proved are. And I agree that that's a circumstance that was proved, but I think that that circumstance is also consistent with the inference that Mr. Engel intended to delay stopping at the treaty camp.
Why isn't the jury in a position to reject that conclusion?
Well, I think part of what the court may be struggling with here is the fact that that's counterintuitive conduct, which goes to the blanket exclusion of Jeanette Stringer's testimony and why that is, in fact, prejudicial. The court erred in excluding Ms. Stringer's testimony. The blanket exclusion was not warranted. She was offered for the proper purpose of providing whole man evidence regarding the past history of mental illness, as well as to explain counterintuitive conduct. And I think your question is a fair one. I think that, you know, many, many people might feel that they want to delay stopping until they reach a safe point. But they also might feel that at a certain point, enough is enough, and they're not going to continue driving.
I want to shift your focus a little bit, counsel, because the point that you're making, I think, is relevant to the suppression issue and whether the fruits of a potentially illegal stop should be suppressed. Can you talk to me about what your view of a reasonably foreseeable activity would be in response to a police officer illegally attempting, assuming that we conclude that there's some illegal activity here, illegally attempting to stop your client in this circumstance? What is reasonably foreseeable?
Well, I think that that question has already been answered by this court in Bergeson. And in the case that I filed a Rule 4 motion on to cite a case today that was not initially cited in my brief, that's State v. Davis. Both of those cases explicitly say that flight is not an attenuating circumstance. It's not conduct that is not reasonably foreseeable. It's something that is foreseeable to an illegal seizure.
Was the person charged with flight in those cases?
No, and I think that that is a fair question that's raised by the state's brief, but I would direct the court to other cases in which subsequent conduct, even if that subsequent conduct was criminalized, was not sufficient to attenuate the subsequent conduct from the illegality. And so sort of the logical conclusion is that if this court has determined that subsequent conduct can be suppressed, and if this court has determined that flight is suppressible conduct, the fact that Mr. Engel happened to have been charged with flight doesn't change this court's prior rulings. I don't see any reason why it would be different. And I would direct the court
Would it not? I mean, an assault on a police officer resisting arrest, you recognize as something that can be charged, that the evidence would not be suppressed for that charge.
Absolutely.
And so what is the legal rationale to distinguish flight from an assault or resisting?
Right. I think that that's a question that this court has grappled with. And assaultive conduct is different, I think, because of just the level that it reaches, that it's violent conduct. And this court, in previous opinions, has sort of analyzed the fact that allowing assaultive conduct to be suppressed would essentially give someone carte blanche to murder a police officer, if you take that to its logical conclusion. So the court has drawn the line.
And how do we do that, though? How do we establish a rule, which I think you're asking us to do? How do we establish a rule that identifies what level of conduct is too much justify the suppression of the evidence?
I think that line has already been drawn, and it's the line between assaultive conduct and mere flight.
And where was that line drawn? Specifically, where should we look to see that?
I think that line has been drawn in the subsequent cases distinguishing Ingram from Bergeson. Bergeson itself describes this distinction, and I would also point the court to State v. Davis, the recent case from April of this year. That case involved a high-speed chase that took place over 10 miles that involved speeds up to 100 miles per hour.
Right, that's also flight. I mean, that's just a different degree of flight, but it would be still the same violation of the statute.
Right, so in that case, actually, the flight did not attenuate the illegality.
But he wasn't charged with flight in that case. He wasn't charged or convicted with flight. And there's also a footnote in that case that says the state failed to raise inevitable discovery. So potentially there could have been a charge of flight plus inevitable discovery to keep in the other evidence that they found in the car.
And I think that, you know, could have been a fair question to be litigated that just wasn't litigated there. And I understand the concern about the difference between charged conduct and not charged conduct. But I would direct the court to State v. Balduc and State v. Combs, both of which were cited in our brief. In Balduc, The defendant in that case, or the appellant rather, had been convicted of obstruction because they had tried to toss some marijuana during an illegal search. And that obstruction charge itself was suppressed because the tossing of the marijuana was foreseeable conduct to an illegal seizure.
I want to draw you away from the examples in the case law and refocus the discussion to what's the principled basis for, what are the principles that we would be applying here? Because in my view, the exclusionary rule is designed to deter illegal conduct. And the question is, how illegal does the conduct have to be? Does it have to be just fleeing, or does it have to be something fleeing plus? And what is that plus? You know, how flagrant does the conduct have to be? I'm just trying to figure out what's the where the line is. If you want us to draw a bright line rule, do you understand my question?
I do, and I think that right now where the law is that flight alone is not an attenuating circumstance, even under circumstances that I would argue are quite a bit more egregious than what's presented here.
So when I was a district court judge, I tried a case involving someone who was driving on city streets at 120 miles an hour for a good 20 minutes, crashing into various posts, et cetera. It didn't hurt anybody, did not, but it was terrifying, caused a lot of ruckus in the city. Is that flagrant enough to break the chain?
I think that that's a different question than we're presented here, because as the footnote in Davis recognizes, that's something more than flight. That's reckless endangerment. That's property destruction. That's something much more than what we're talking about here, which is nothing more than flight. There's no allegation of property destruction, reckless driving, anything assaultive. You know, for what it's worth, at the point where Officer Turison steps out of the vehicle and Mr. Engel continues driving and then accelerates away, there's no allegation that that was anything like an assault. You know, there are cases where flight involves something more that's assaultive, right? Driving dangerously past an officer. There's one of the cases where an officer is reaching in to the car when the car drives away, and the car, you know, injures, well, I don't know if about injures, but assaults the officer, basically. I think that's a different circumstance here. And so I do think that flight alone is suppressible. Whether it's something more, I think, is a different question that this court does not need to address.
So, but if we adopt the rule of law that you're advocating for, a police officer turns on their lights, turns on the sirens, without reasonable articulable suspicion to stop somebody, the individual is allowed to just continue driving away.
I think that's the result that Bergeson already allows, essentially.
And how do you square that with the self-help cases, that people are not allowed to resort to self-help with an illegal seizure?
All of those cases involve assaultive conduct. Again, even if it's minor assaultive conduct, like resisting arrest by twisting and turning, all of those involve assaultive conduct. And I think that that's the line, again, that's been drawn by Bergeson. Well, if nothing more on this point, I will return just briefly to the sufficiency of the evidence point.
So I did want to ask about that. So your argument is that there's a reasonable alternative theory.
Yes.
That the intent was not to elude, irrespective of what the jury found, that there's a reasonable theory that the circumstances proof show that they just wanted to get to a safe place. But what are the outer limits of that? Could someone just not stop for an hour? I want to get home. You know, like, what does that mean? If you're not obligated to pull over, like, you know, pretty immediately, can you go for 3 miles, 10, 40, 100?
No, I think that this is a line that's been drawn by the Minnesota legislature. The difference between felony fleeing, which is a specific intent crime, and misdemeanor failure to elude. Failure to elude is a petty misdemeanor with no intent. Where it's intentional, it's a misdemeanor. And so I think that we should be deferring to the Minnesota legislature as already having drawn those lines about when conduct goes from a mere misdemeanor up to a felony level with that specific intent to flee as opposed to merely delaying pulling over.
With your sufficiency argument, I had another question on that. It seems like you're asking us to recognize a new defense to fleeing, and that defense being some mental issues with PTSD. Has PTSD been recognized as a defense to fleeing?
No, and we're absolutely not arguing diminished capacity. I think that the difference is that we've been arguing about how that conduct should be interpreted, and that PTSD diagnosis is a lens through which it can be interpreted. And that's why Ms. Stringer's testimony was so important. PTSD is not a defense at all, but it is important context as to whether the intent was formed. Thank you. I see my time is finished. I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
And counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you can get yourself settled, adjust the podium, and proceed when you're set.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. This case is not close. Appellant is on squad video fleeing the police, and he's on body cam video admitting that he intentionally fled the police. And that's because of two key definitions. First, per the statute, refusing to stop is fleeing. He admitted he intentionally refused to stop. And as this court has pointed out, eluding police includes avoiding police. That's part of the definition of elude. And appellant admitted, again, on this body cam video, that he intentionally avoided the police. So there's nothing to interpret here. Appellant admitted he committed this crime. Appellant's defense seems to be, well, he was only refusing to stop to avoid temporarily, and that's not enough. But there's no statutory language or case law that says you have X number of miles or X number of minutes to keep going before you stop, and it won't actually count as fleeing. I mean, think of the chaos that would ensue, and how do you draw that line? Maybe he only feels safe at his mom's place in Fargo. Does he get to drive there? That would be a silly exercise in line drawing that is not required by case law or the statute. The case law is quite clear. You don't get to engage in self-help. And there's no distinction in the case law that says, well, fleeing self-help is okay, but if you lay a finger on the officer, then that's not okay. Again, it'd be very hard to draw that line. How far do you have to flee? And not only is there sort of the chaos of officers never knowing when someone's going to stop, as Judge John pointed out, there's obviously officer safety concerns where the officer doesn't know, where is this person leading me to? Is the person leading me to an unsafe place? Is the person going to stop in 2 miles, or is the person not going to stop until they're forced to stop, as in this case?
Mr. Raggetts, I appreciate the description of the implications of this case, but I think we're skipping over the initial hurdle that I think your client has to pass, and that is, was there a reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop in the first place? And does everything, if the answer to that is no, does everything that happens after that end up in a suppression posture? And so my question to you as to the first part of my first part of the issue is there a difference between I don't know if there is a law that has been violated versus I see something that appears not to be in compliance with the law, which is, I think, the officer's testimony with respect to the registration or document that's affixed to the back of the truck.
Your Honor, I promise I will answer that question in just a second, but I want to preface it by saying That is a slightly harder issue you don't need to reach here, because the case law is clear. Even if there is a bad stop, you don't get to engage in self-help. You can still be convicted of fleeing. There isn't a single case where a court has said the fleeing charge is bad here. It was a natural consequence of a bad stop. That's self-help. That's not allowed. So you don't need to decide whether
those... I mean, I don't know that that's entirely accurate when I read, especially when I read Macklemore. I don't know that that's an entirely accurate description. So let's get to my question.
Yeah, Macklemore and Clinton seem to be the two cases that appellant primarily relies on, but those are cases that distinguish Givens. And what Givens says is where you see something and you're not sure what it is, that's enough for the minimal test of reasonable articulable suspicion. In both Clinton and Macklemore, the officer had more information than that. In Clinton, there was a dealer advertisement plate and a matching decal next to it. In Macklemore, the officer said he knew it was a registration form, he just didn't know if it was approved. Whereas in Givens is just like this case. The officer could see what appeared to be a paper registration card out of the window, but could not read it due to the darkness. So that's the same situation here. The officer, sure, it could have been a paper registration form, could also have been a for sale sign. The officer just didn't know. Reasonable articulable suspicion is a very low test, as this court has repeatedly acknowledged, and it's a minimal intrusion here for the officer to make a stop to see, oh, is that a valid form? Are you within the 21 days?
How is that any different than an officer looking at a person on the street and seeing something that might be bulging out of their waistband, and the officer says, oh, I wonder if that's a gun. I'm going to stop and frisk them and see if that's a gun. How is that... The officer doesn't have an articulable basis that a crime has been committed, but may have a suspicion that something might be up. Well, how is that any different? And you'd agree with me that that would be an illegal.
Sure, case. Yeah, definitely. Now, if the officer actually saw the gun, then they can do a stop. We know that from Timberlake. You might have a permit, but the officer can still stop and check. And here, maybe this was a registration form, maybe it wasn't. The officers can stop and check, just like in Timberlake, because here there's an affirmative duty to have that registration form.
They can stop and frisk the car?
No, they can stop and walk up to the car. And if they get to the car and see, oh, yes, this is a valid registration form, then they say, sorry to bother you, be on your way. I've confirmed my suspicion or my lack of suspicion. But reasonable articulable suspicion
is... What case are you citing for that proposition?
For
that an officer can stop a car based on uncertainty as to whether something might comply with the law?
Givens. That's what Givens says. Givens says if the officer is not sure if there is a valid registration form, then the officer can look to see. The cases appellant cites, there's more than that dispel the suspicion. But if Givens, if all you have is, it's dark, I can't see, and that's the difference between the bulge situation. You don't have an affirmative duty to walk around with no bulges in your pockets. You do have an affirmative duty if you're driving without a license plate to have this form. Just like if you have a gun, you have an affirmative duty to have a permit to carry, and the officers can stop and check that.
So the officer did not say that he wasn't sure if it was valid. He just said that he couldn't determine from what he looked at.
He didn't know what it was at all. This is not like a case where you see a form, but you're like, I'm not sure if the form was properly signed. The officer said he could not read what was in the window, just like in Givens, because it's dark. It's at night. And so there's a two-minute stop to confirm it, and if everything's fine, motorist goes on their way. Again, it's the very, very not high test for reasonable articulable suspicion. It can't just be a whim. This wasn't a whim. There was no license plate there. And if you don't have a license plate, you have to have that form.
And in your view, the objective basis of suspicion of reasonable criminal activity is what?
That there is no form that's required, just like in Givens. And just like if you've got a gun, maybe you've got a permit, maybe you don't, the officers get to check.
Could an officer stop somebody? They see a flash of light by the driver's shoulder, and the officer says, boy, that looks like that could be the seatbelt buckle. I want to stop them to make sure they're buckled in.
I think we perhaps need a little more information if that is a reasonable explanation. I guess I don't know where the lights are for seatbelt buckles, but I think... Yes, again, we have the minimal test for a reasonable articulable suspicion, and if the officer says, you know, there's an affirmative duty to have a seatbelt on, just like there is to have a sticker if you don't have a license plate. I think that might count here. I think our facts here are different. They're more like givens. And I want to ultimately come back to the fact that you don't need to decide this issue unless you decide that fleeing is a valid response to what a motorist perceives to be a bad stop.
And why is Bergerson not on all fours here?
Because Bergerson's a suppression of evidence case. All of the cases that appellant cites are suppression of evidence cases where the drugs or the guns you ultimately found, the taint hasn't been lifted, and so you still suppress it. None of them say that conduct, other than abandonment, is suppressed. None of them say, oh, you can actually engage in self-help. Those are cases where, again, it's a Fourth Amendment taint, suppression of evidence issue.
And you're drawing a distinction between the suppression of physical evidence versus the suppression of testimony that would, which is also evidence, which would describe behaviors. Or perhaps the squad video, which would depict behaviors.
Appellant never argued below the squad video shouldn't come in, the body cam video shouldn't come in, the officer's testimony should be precluded. Appellant's argument was his conduct here was legal. So we're talking about suppression of evidence versus authorizing conduct. His argument is, I intended to stop, so my conduct was legal. There was no fleeing here.
Well, I mean, they did argue that the fruits of the illegal stop should be suppressed, which would be everything that happened, right?
Well, I'm not sure that an officer's testimony about what he saw has ever been described as the fruit of an illegal stop.
Well, what about in Balduck, where I think it's a conviction for obstructing legal process and for receiving stolen property, and there was a search, I think a warranted search, that was turned out to be unlawful for the stolen property. But in the context of that search, I think the guy tossed his marijuana plants, which were never found, I think. It wasn't just like suppressing contraband and a later charge for the having contraband. It was actually suppression of testimony that he destroyed his marijuana plants. I think that was the obstructing legal process there. You know, and we reversed both those convictions.
Right. Abandonment.
So
abandonment
is a mixed bag. It's not quite like the other ones,
well,
where the only charge was the actual contraband.
Right. But that is not in the self-help category, because all the cases say abandoning evidence is a predictable response. That's not the sort of self-help like fleeing or assaulting. And the obstruction here was the abandonment. So again, it's not authorizing otherwise illegal conduct. It's not illegal to abandon something the way it is illegal to flee or to assault an officer. And an appellant's argument seems to be, well, if it's a natural response, then it can't be criminal conduct. Well, I mean, if you think an officer is illegally arresting you, shoving him might well be a natural response too, but that would be assault. So I guess that's okay too then, as long as it's a natural response. But that's not what the case law says. The case law says no self-help. And we're not talking about suppressing guns or drugs or anything else. I don't think the Balduck case talked about suppressing testimony. I thought it was just whether there was sufficient evidence of guilt. And there wasn't there because the abandonment was a natural consequence of the actions.
I'm not sure about that. I think that the obstructing was by virtue, of destroying the marijuana plants that I think were that later located. I think it was testimonial. I'm not sure.
I'm just not sure that was the basis for the decision. But regardless, abandonment, and when the obstruction is the abandonment, there's really... It would create a huge hole in the case law if we said, well, we have to suppress the evidence because you logically abandoned it or reasonably abandoned it after a bad stop, but we can still charge you for abandoning it. Then it would make that a meaningless distinction. But no case law says fleeing is valid self-help. No case law says you can flee.
I'm having a very difficult time squaring the argument that you're making today, which is I completely understand it, that self-help is not permitted with Bergerson. I'm just having a hard time squaring those two arguments.
In none of these cases was the defendant charged with fleeing. None of these cases say, oh, the fleeing charge has to go too.
But that conduct is involved in, I mean, that's the argument that regarding the purge of the taint, right?
Well, the taint is these guns and drugs were tainted because you wouldn't have gotten them but for this bad stop. No one forced you to flee. That's self-help again. This is just suppression of evidence. None of these cases say if you had been fleeing, that would have been okay too. That's self-help. And obviously the legislature didn't intend that. The results would be chaos, as I've already argued. But there's just no case law that supports it. The case law that appellant relies on are Fourth Amendment suppression of evidence cases, not conduct is authorized because it was reasonably predictable, at least conduct other than the abandonment that goes along with suppression of evidence issues.
In this scenario, if the sticker in the window was invalid, would that be evidence that would have to be suppressed? They couldn't charge that crime in this scenario? Like the fleeing happens, everything else is the same, charge for fleeing, what happens
I think
to that?
So. I think if this was an illegal stop, any evidence you obtained from that, like photographs or the sticker itself, would have to be suppressed. It would only be a bad stop if you were not in a given situation, if you were in a situation where you had enough information that there was no reasonable basis for the fact that you were ultimately right about the sticker. But if it's a given situation where you just can't tell what's in that window, you know, maybe it says, I love kittens. He just doesn't know. Given says you can check that out. But again, it doesn't matter here because even with a bad stop, you don't get to flee.
And just to follow up on Judge Schmidt's question, if there were drugs in the car, they found drugs in the car when they stopped him, would you agree that and the stop were illegal, that would have to be suppressed?
Clearly. That's what Bergerson and all those cases deal with, suppressing physical evidence that was only obtained because the police acted badly.
And so your distinction is if it's physical evidence, it's a bad stop, we're assuming it's a bad stop, any physical evidence that is discovered as a result of the bad stop would be suppressed, but evidence of fleeing would not be suppressed.
Illegal conduct is not authorized by a bad stop. That's my argument here. Evidence can be suppressed, but a bad stop does not authorize you to engage in self-help. That's what all of these cases say. My time is up. If I can make one more quick point about direct versus circumstantial evidence, which came up. This is a direct evidence case. He admitted on tape what he did. If it was a circumstantial case, you'd have to assume the jury didn't believe anything he said, which puts him in the same situation.
Thank you.
And unless there are additional questions, thank you.
And counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, but we'll give you a little extra time because he also went over.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start by responding to the false distinction that the state is trying to draw here that I think, Judge Frisch, your question gets to between physical evidence and evidence of conduct. That's not a distinction that's supported in the case law. And in fact, the Combs case and the Balduc case both involve conduct. The Combs case in particular, I would direct the court to footnote 1. The conduct that was suppressed there was littering conduct. So the state's argument that subsequent criminal conduct, cannot be suppressed, it's simply belied by the case law. I also want to address the argument that the case here is analogous to Givens. In U.S. v. Givens, the law enforcement officer there testified that he was able to read valid temporary tags at night previously and had experience with fraudulent tags. And so because of that prior experience, being able to read lawful tags at night previously and their experience with fraudulent tags, that informed why their inability to see the tag there gave them an affirmative belief that it was fraudulent. And so Givens is readily distinguishable because here, as I think Your Honor has noted, what we have is essentially uncertainty. The officer just didn't know and so pulled over Mr. Engel to check. And, you know, I think it's worth noting that Minnesota courts have found license plate checks to not amount to a search or seizure precisely because they are not invasive, because they don't require a stop of the car. The argument that the state is making here would turn that precedent on its head with regard to anyone who has a temporary registration. It's also a standard that would be easily manipulable by law enforcement, and I think should give this court pause. If the standard is, because it's dark out and because I'm driving far enough behind this vehicle, I can't make out what that sign is, I have reasonable suspicion now, that essentially incentivizes an officer who wants to stop a vehicle, wants to make a pretextual stop, to simply keep driving behind at a far enough distance that they've manufactured reasonable suspicion.
Mr. Raggetts makes a very important point, and that is we do not want to encourage individuals to engage in self-help procedures in response to the police's exercise of law of authority, lawful and perhaps even unlawful. We don't want to encourage that kind of behavior. Do you want to comment on that in conjunction with this case?
Again, I think when we look at the cases involving self-help, what the court is concerned about is violence. It is assaultive conduct. Even when it's pushing away an officer so that you can run, that is clearly an intervening circumstance under governing case law. Fleeing alone has already been deemed by this court to be a predictable response to an illegality. I think that...
I'm sorry, which case did we decide where fleeing alone, there could not be evidence of fleeing alone for a fleeing charge?
There is no case either direction where fleeing itself was suppressed. What we're arguing is the Bergeson case tells us that fleeing itself is not conduct that attenuates the illegality of the seizure, and we also know that subsequent conduct can be suppressed, that there's not a false distinction that the state is trying to draw between physical evidence and non-physical evidence.
Could your client have been charged with a petty misdemeanor for failing to yield the right-of-way?
Absolutely.
And so why then isn't that in itself? Because at the time the officer turned on the lights, I'm assuming your client had no idea why they're getting pulled over.
Correct.
At that point, did not pull over and continues driving. So why isn't that a circumstance proved of failing to yield the right of way or immediately pulling over to then get into, to purge the taint of the initial stop?
So I guess I agree with you as it pertains to our sufficiency of the evidence argument that that's the distinction. But I think if I'm understanding Your Honor correctly, it's a question of whether that would have also been suppressible.
Yeah.
And yes, if this court finds the seizure was not supported by reasonable suspicion, then that conduct would also be suppressible. I see I have no more time.
We're going to give you a little extra time, so if you have another point, feel free to make it.
Thank you. I do just want to briefly touch on the prosecutorial misconduct in this case. I know that I don't have much time to address it, but I think that it's worth noting the jury question. There were two jury questions that I think indicate that the discovery misconduct by the state was not something that was harmless, was not harmless error. The district court essentially found that the prosecutor committed egregious misconduct by failing to disclose the crux of its case. Testimony that was inculpatory by Officer Turison, but found that our remedies were not appropriate because Mr. Engel had not been prejudiced. And so I want to just note that Mr. Engel's defense unknowingly played into the state's case. And I would direct the court to Moore and Miramontes, both of which are cited in our brief. And those cases involve a situation where...
And counsel, I'll ask you to just quickly sum up because we are now moving past.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Those cases involve a situation where similarly a discovery violation and that a defendant unknowingly played into the state's theory. And I think that that's what happened here. So I appreciate the court's consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for the arguments today and the briefs submitted. The matter is submitted, and we will get an opinion out within the statutory time frame.